People talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight, griping about the way things are weak. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking. Down with life, I'm fighting in a fog and dying. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you run down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's excuse me, the name of this program here on White Resistance Radio. .com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Here's something interesting. It came to me on it's from UNS, at UNZ. That's Ron UNS's website, I believe. And it says here, Seattle is 7% black. Between 2012 and 2016, blacks committed 56% of firearm homicides in the, let's just see here, well, this just suddenly disappeared on me, in a 65% white city. So I guess the others would be Hispanic. So, all right. So 7% of Seattle is black, but in the period between 2012 and 2016, blacks committed 56% of the firearm homicides in this overwhelmingly white city. I mean, so a black crime, it's a problem. Yeah. The color of crime. In 71% of white King County, Washington, which is the where Seattle is, 85% of firearm violence is committed by non-whites. In early March of this year, Kings County Public Health Department released the firearm deaths among residents of King County and Seattle. What's incredible is an admission buried deep within the report. 39 of the 69 homicides by firearm were committed between 2012 and 2016 were committed by blacks. Remember those demographics cited above. This means 56% of firearm homicides in 65% white Seattle in 2012, 13, 14, 15, 16 were committed by a racial group, making up only 7% of the city. But don't worry, the authors were quick to excuse any black firearms violence on white privilege and discrimination. Never mind, whites committed 82% of the firearm suicides in Seattle and King County during the same period. This is some of the stuff in the report to try to explain away the statistics. Recognizing that firearm violence cannot be extricated from generations of racial and other forms of systemic oppression, it's important to be aware of racial and ethnic group disparities in premature deaths. Many communities of color have experienced social and economic discrimination and other forms of racism. This can contribute to concentrated economic disadvantage, a community risk factor for interpersonal violence, and can negatively affect the health and well-being of these communities. So, allegedly, if you stretch that out, what they're saying is, well, yeah, it's true. Blacks commit wildly disproportionate violence, criminal violence, and murder. But it's not really their fault. It's racism and oppression and so on. It's a stretch of the imagination that if two blacks engage in the drug trade, have a disagreement, and one shoots and kills the other, that it's somehow racism. Or if one black, wanting money, assaults another black and kills him, that you can somehow blame racism. You know, this era that we live in screams for some common sense, desperately needing common sense. I was following Twitter earlier today, and I saw this interesting question posed about the weekend in Toronto. You see, the weekend we just finished is the annual Carabana. They celebrate the Caribbean, and there's much noise and parade and dancing and so on. You know, and it's not my thing. I'll simply leave it at that. But Carabana regularly attracts violence. In fact, every year there are shootings there. Just trying to find get the exact figures here. I think it was about 11 people shot over the weekend. What's very frustrating in all this is what we're not told. This is a big problem. It's not just what we're told. It's usually what we are not told that is interesting. I am trying to find this here, and I may end up having to just summarize it. Jeff with a J posted this on Twitter. In Toronto this weekend, 13 victims in 11 different shootings across Toronto this long weekend, including 7 people injured in a nightclub shooting. My God, this is Canada. Why is this happening? I'm still waiting to see details of these shootings. But this is what I wrote. When will our controlled media inform us who the victims and shooters or suspects were? This was Carabana weekend, and there are usually shootings black on black. Inquiring minds would like to know. Clue, I doubt it was feral Icelanders doing the shooting. My guess, and I believe in being accurate. My guess is that when we finally do get the information, that almost all of the victims were black, and the perpetrators or the suspects were black. This is part of Caravana. Very often there's, it seems that when a black gangster sees one of his enemies in a crowd, completely oblivious to the to inaccurate shooting or the damage he may cause, he opens fire and non-involved people get hit. I'm hoping we'll have more information coming up tomorrow. But it's the Jeff asks, you know, well, what's happening in Canada? Well, basically, what's happening in Canada is we allow in people with a high propensity for violence, and you can hardly be surprised if they act according to their normal behavior. Surprised at this. I was quite amused at the way a lot of writers, especially the National Post, have picked up on this obscene gathering of the very wealthy and hangers-on, fashion designers, that total twit Prince Harry, the head of Google, and so on, in an exclusive resort on the island of Sicily. And this is all about the environment. I'm sorry, but, you know, like climate change, global warming, they were going to have these discussions. Now, these are all confidential, incidentally, which I find interesting. would-be social justice warriors don't want their discussions made public. Anyway, they're probably going to be discussing how ordinary people ought to be doing more to stop using carbons or hydrocarbons, stop generating so much carbon dioxide. You know, maybe we should get rid of our cars and have bicycles or other things like that. Well, at this conference where they were going to discuss such weighty matters, these people flew in many of them, the 300 plus people, over 105 private jets landed at the airport in Palermo. Several of the participants arrived in yachts the size of battleships, and point being, all of these are just gobbling up obscene quantities of gasoline. And this was the take on the event by Chris Sully, who's a columnist for the National Post. Celebrity slacktivism, a bad look for royals. That's his headline. Despite what some scandalized British headlines have suggested, Prince Harry, Duke of Sussex, has not claimed to be helping to save the world from climate change, but by only planning to get his 37-year-old wife pregnant one more time. Quote, to maximum, he tells primatologist Jane Goodall in an interview in the current issue of British Vogue. It was the content of some store-bought musings about the perils facing planet Earth and its future inhabitants. Quote, this place is borrowed, that's what he said. But it was presented more as a half-joke than as an earnest plan to help out the biosphere. Good thing, too, because not long after these headlines landed, we learned Harry was off to Sicily for a massive Google-sponsored climate change celebrity gab fest.
Needless to say, he didn't row there. Italian media reported that more than 100 private jets and several super yachts had delivered the actors, singers, supermodels, and tech magazine. I'm sorry, tech magnates to the conference on the island of Sicily. All reportedly had to sign non-disclosure agreements about what went on, which is a brilliant new innovation in climate change slacktivism. Quote, our climate change discussions were not only important enough to justify heroic eruptions of carbon dioxide, but so important that we can't tell you anything about them. It's really good to see the blatant hypocrisy of these people skewered. Something, it's petty to criticize climate activists for their own emissions. I was recently taken to task by myriad correspondents, many of whom were not liberal partisans, for suggesting that a family long weekend surfing on Vancouver Island was a strange look for a prime minister trying to sell Canadians on a carbon tax with the very future of the planet, he argues, hanging in the balance. Honestly, it baffles me. Is the idea that celebrity advocacy for decarbonized lifestyles will inspire so many other people to adopt that that we should forgive the celebrity's own excesses? If people actually take their environmental cues from the likes of Leonardo DiCaprio, Harry Styles, model Naomi Campbell, and Orlando Bloom, all were reportedly in Sicily, then surely they would be far more inspired if the celebrities actually made half a personal effort instead of just running their mouths about it and preaching. But there will always be films, and there will always be, they will always need actors, and there will always be pop music, and it will always need singers. And fame being what it is, a lot of actors and singers will always end up being insufferable flakes. The monarchy, Harry's dad and brother are front of the line to lead, it isn't nearly so immutable. No other Western royal family has managed to maintain such a conspicuously opulent lifestyle while maintaining head of state status and widespread affection. And he actually goes on more about the royal family and the succession and so on, but for our purposes, I think that's pretty much it. Now, this is another interesting little piece. It's a letter to the editor about Canada's former freeloader general, or governor general, the very entitled Adrienne Clarkson. Now, she was governor general a little over 10 years ago, but it emerges that all former governors general get a budget of up to $200,000 a year. Now, these are former governor generals to fulfill duties that might be asked of them, speaking engagements, for instance, and so on. You would think if the sponsoring organization cannot afford to provide them the transportation or even an honorarium, they can always say no. The $200,000, they can tap up to that with very little in the way of accounting over that, or for very big items, they do have to make an accounting. Adrienne Clarkson, apparently for every year since she was Governor General, has taken the full $200,000. That's an awful lot of money. Well, you ask, well, what does it go for? Well, apparently, Secretarial Health. An office. When a former Governor General who's out of office. You know, it was no longer has that those responsibilities. Why would they need an office? They don't all have one, but some do. And of course, travel. It's a sweet thing, and because it's the Governor General, the accounts are not subject to access to information. So a lot of it is very secret. Anyway, this is a very good letter to the editor. The photograph of a former Governor General Adrian Clarkson with a set of 5 medals hanging from her jacket was both shocking and dismaying. What a terrible insult to veterans who were awarded their medals for risking their lives, sometimes with terrible consequences. Either Madam Clarkson bought her set of medals from a military auction, or they were specially cast for her. But for what? And this is where he goes into some really great sarcasm. A medal for surviving the campaign to collect pensions from both the CPC, that was her former employee, and the Governor General's office. One cast for bravery in the line of fire by ignoring those critical of her narcissism. Obviously another one was awarded for last one standing at the public trough. Maybe another is for being the most active proponent of change for everything I can think of. Even though one must admire her ability to casually ignore the criticism of others, as she hungrily sucks on the public tit. shouldn't at least some of that money go to those with real medical problems, as she talks about the veterans? Yeah, it's a scandal. Adrian Clarkson was outrageous. She was appointed, I believe, by the Liberal government as the province of Ontario's representative in Paris. And eventually that position was abolished. And for the very good reason, Ontario didn't really need a representative in Paris to do what? Anyway, that brought her a nice fat salary and a very swish apartment in a very tony area of Paris. Well, then she became Governor General. And as Governor General, she certainly swanned around as a most entitled individual. She took an interest in the Arctic. Well, I think that's admirable. There's certainly much to be said about that. And she organized, I believe it was 2 conferences of Arctic nations. So those would be, that would include, of course, Canada, the United States, Russia, Norway, Sweden, Iceland, Denmark, Finland. I don't think I've left anybody out here, but these turned out to be extremely pricey gab fests. And on one, she brought an entourage of several dozen of basically her friends, hangers on government expense, to go and chat about the Arctic. Now, this was the sort of just absolute entitlement. And you might ask, well, what's the Governor General's job? Well, okay, I'll tell you. The Governor General in the Canadian system is the stand-in for the Queen. You see, in Canada, the head of state is the Queen. And things are done in her name. So, for instance, if you're charged with a crime, let's say a DUI, your charge will read Regina, that's the Queen, V or versus you. And things are done when legislation is passed federally by both the House of Commons and the Senate. Before it becomes law, it gets royal assent, so the monarch signs it. But because of the complexity of the British Commonwealth and the countries that still have the Queen as the head of state, that responsibility is passed on to the Governor General. So the Governor General is the stand-in for the Queen, signs legislation, represents the Queen on formal functions, the opening of Parliament, and many other things. Presides at many public functions, of openings of important conferences or festivals, and so on. That's the Governor General's role. The Governor General is not a policymaker, and the Governor General is supposed to be very much above politics. And Adrian Clarkson, imagined quite an activist role for herself. Here's a very interesting contrast between the United States and Canada. Although the warning, which is from the American government, will be equally applicable to Canada. Spy document warns of China threat. Academia is at risk. Look out for colleagues rummaging through desks. Beware of spies who can exploit your divided national loyalties, greed, or ego. And monitor foreign visitors at all times, especially last-minute additions to group tours. These are among the tips outlined in an extraordinary manual drafted by the FBI for universities and other research facilities in the United States, warning about the threat of economic and scientific espionage by China and advising how to combat it. Isn't that interesting? You know, especially for Canadians, several different regimes over the years, going back to Pierre Trudeau in the early 70s, have been huge fans of Red China. They saw great trade opportunities, and they wanted to, as the jargon goes, to engage with them. More savvy people warn that the communist Chinese government is intent on subversion and spying and meddling, and more than that, in thieving, in espionage, stealing scientific and in some cases military technology. That there's just bad news. Okay, so this warning came from the FBI. As Canada grapples with how to counter Peking's meddling here, the American document called China, the Risk to Academia, recommends a level of alertness that seems almost a throwback to Cold War days. And it's aimed at a milieu, university and college campuses, where academic freedom and openness are sacrosanct and government interference usually spurned. Those institutions have also, though, been welcoming tens of thousands of students and scholars from China in recent years. Quote, in every university and institution, every university and institution's responsibility to safeguard its information, states the document. The Chinese government poses a particular threat to U.S. academia for a variety of reasons. In Canada, where 143,000, that's the size of a city, where 143,000 Chinese students are enrolled in colleges and universities, there's little evidence of the same level of vigilance or willingness to name China as a prime victim. You see, this is a huge problem with cultural Marxism and with the present liberal regime in Canada. If you can't specifically name a problem, you can't solve it. Or at least you haven't a chance of solving it. And back to the issue of black crime. If you talk vaguely about gang violence, it doesn't necessarily get you very close to a solution, because it's black gang violence for the most part. That's important. Gangs are would seem to cover a wide variety of associations, some of which might be maybe a little bit offensive, but harmless, or at least not criminal. So, like in Toronto, the frequent bemoaning of the fact that there's this gang violence doesn't get at the problem. It's mostly, almost entirely black gang violence, because if you can't name the problem, you can't really solve it, or you come up with silly solutions. Anyway, getting back to the report, there's no willingness to name China as the villain. But if you talk about possible espionage, you're not talking about espionage committed by Uruguay, for instance, or Vanuatu. The RCMP says it has produced no such document and has no country-specific enforcement programs, while universities report little in the way of warnings from security agencies. No, they're asleep at the switch. The country's spy agency does acknowledge an economic espionage problem without naming any one country. Once again, you know, if everybody is a suspect, then to some extent you waste an awful lot of your time on utterly innocent people. I mean, as awful as Haiti might be, I don't think Haiti poses a threat to Canada in terms of economic espionage. But for politically correct reasons, the Ottawa establishment does not want to or name the specific culprit. Unidentified foreign powers are using, quote, a range of traditional and non-traditional intelligence collection tradecraft, and that's a direct quote, to try to acquire Canadian technology and expertise, which could result in lost jobs and the competitiveness said Tahira Mufti, a spokeswoman for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. That doesn't that paragraph tell you just about all you need to know? So foreign powers are using, you know, various means, a range of traditional and non-traditional means of collecting intelligence. Okay. But who? I mean, who should we be afraid of? Should we be afraid of that graduate student from Burundi? Or are we more likely to have, should we be concentrating our efforts on that visiting student from China? You see, if you can't name the problem, you can't solve it. And I think part of this is political correctness, and they do, you know, our establishment doesn't want to give offense to the Red Chinese. I think we ought to say, well, why not? You know, if we honesty and frankness have a real place in dealing with other countries, and the spokes thing for the. Our spy agency, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, Tahira Mufti, doesn't sound like a traditional Canadian to me, does it? No. Quote, CSIS routinely engages with a variety of stakeholders, including in the private sector and universities, to advise them of potential threats, she says. I love that. A variety of stakeholders. What does that mean? It's a bureaucracy shorthand for organizations that are more or less on the same side, especially now this is not the issue, but when they talk about immigration stakeholders, it doesn't mean you and me. It means organizations that basically support the open door immigration policy. Mufti pointed to a 5-paragraph section on economic espionage in the service's recent annual report, and a speech by Director David Vignon of last year, warning business leaders about the threat in generic terms. You see, generic terms. I mean, Are we worried perhaps that Luxembourg is spying, could steal our economic secrets? Well, no. U.S. authorities, on the other hand, have made clear they consider improper siphoning of secrets and other advanced knowledge from research facilities by China specifically to be a major problem. In other words, they named the problem, they named the perpetrator. FBI Director Christopher Wray controversially pointed the finger last year at students and professors of Chinese background, suggesting a whole society response to the threat is needed. Several people have been charged in connection with such activity. The RISC Academia document takes some pains to acknowledge that immigrants and visiting students and scholars are integral to the United States research system, saying the vast majority of those from China are in the States for legitimate academic reasons. Having recognized that, that still doesn't mean there's a problem. I always find it pathetic that we are so infected with minority-itis that we have to make those acknowledgments. Yes, I'm sure graduate students from China that are in Canada to learn maybe something about economics or maybe something about English or French literature are probably not likely to be spies. But some are, but especially some that are perhaps more in the sciences or technology. But this is that American document, the RISC Academia, but it lays out in detail the Chinese government's tactic to vacuum up intellectual property, such as using some students and professors as non-traditional collectors, that is, not trained spies, but people who are taught, who are tasked specifically to do maybe one or two things. And the document suggests that colleges and other research organizations should play a part in countering these tactics. The document warns that foreign adversaries, its title singling out adversaries from China, could elicit information by using flattery, assuming knowledge, asking leading questions, or feigning ignorance. So we're providing some of the behavioral clues that perhaps should set off alarm bells. Intelligence agents will look to exploit vulnerabilities, keying in on ideology or loyalty to a country other than the United States. A person from Red China who's a loyal Communist Party member. They also might work on greed or financial stress, ego or self-image, and anger, revenge or disaffections. All of these are fertile emotions that they might play upon to elicit information. Quote, they can spend years targeting an individual and developing a relationship that leads the student, professor, or researcher, either wittingly or unwittingly, to provide information to the foreign adversary. That's a quotation. The briefing suggests ways to detect insider threats. Employees who as early as the job application stage may have been directed by a foreign government to gain access to universities with sought-after research programs. Warning signs could include someone who insists on working in private, volunteers himself for classified projects, rummages through offices or desks of others, has mysterious absences or displays the unexplained affluence. The FBI also notes that campus visits by foreign researchers can be risky. Quote, foreign researchers sometimes add individuals to the last minute in an attempt to steal your information. So that a mysterious person who really doesn't seem to have much of a background suddenly joins the tour.
And this is something to be aware of. So very, very interesting advice. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on LightResistanceRadio.com. His father was a great country and western star, Hank Williams Jr. There'll never be another one like him. Hank Williams Sr. Hank Williams Jr. was his son, very, very young when his father died. And early on, Hank Williams Jr., even as a child, did a lot of singing engagements and was, of course, early on always pressed to sing his father's hit tunes. But as he grew up, he wanted to make his mark for his own style, and he developed a form of country rock. I find him a really great entertainer. So here are a few songs from Hank Williams Jr. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she could go and grind. The interest is up, and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go down. In the woods, you see, a woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk.
California and South Africa.
women side by side, across the mountains and the valleys wide. We came to Big Muddy and we poured in the blood of the Tennessee mare and the Tennessee stud. Now we got a little baby on the cabin floor, a little horse coat lay around the door. And I love the girl with the golden. Bad case of rambling in our shoes.
And that's Hank Williams Jr. This is Paul Frob. You're on the Fighting Side, and we'll be back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as they always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Frob, and you're on the Fighting Side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's head of main. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes, and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf.